Well, thank you very much. And our gospel lesson is from the parable chapter of Matthew, chapter 13, 44 to 52, which brings the seven parables to a conclusion that Jesus has given. I would just like to set this for my own satisfaction within the context of Matthew, and that is, please remember that the parables of Matthew 13 are actually parables that occur in chapter 13. They are not free-floating parables that are scattered throughout the gospel, so that you find one, let's say, in chapter 8, another one in chapter 16. No, chapters 11 and 12 of Matthew begin the resistance to Jesus. It begins in chapter 11, verse 2, with John the Baptist raising the question, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" It continues on with Jesus excoriating the people for their attitude toward John, and then especially with the leaders accusing him of being in league with Satan. And then, at the end of chapter 12, in verses 46 to 50, his family comes, his mother and his brothers standing outside asking for him. And in the context, this can only be hostile. That is to say, be a good boy, come home. This isn't working out very well. Now, in response to all this comes chapter 13. And you'll notice, if you just think of it like this, it's actually fairly late in the book. Now, the parables then are in direct response to the growing rejection of him. Thus, in verse 14, it says the prophecy of Isaiah is being filled up for them who do not see. They will hear with hearing and will not understand, and see they will see and will not see, and so forth. So the parable of the sower, which is the first of the parables, is a parable that answers this question. If Jesus is the Son of Man come to bring the kingdom of God, how come everybody isn't on board with this operation? And the answer is, there's nothing wrong with God's activity. There's nothing wrong with the seed. It's not as if he throws out seed and there's bad seed and good seed. It's all good. It's the hard heart of man, or man overcome by the cares of this world, and so on. So, in other words, these parables are now depictions of what the reign and rule of God brought by Jesus Christ is like in the first instance in Jesus. So this continues on with the parable of the wheat and the tares, which starts in verse 24. And this tells you that everything will not be smooth sailing. There will be good grain coming up, but there will also be, by the activity of Satan, contrary activities that are going to make it difficult, yet God will make sure that it does ultimately triumph. Next parable in verse 31 is the mustard seed. Now this tells us that in the whole operation of the kingdom of God, it begins very small. For example, in a Galilean rabbi. And finally, spreads out so it becomes like a great tree and the birds of the air nest in it. And if you have your Nestle text, you'll notice in the side margin, there are references to Daniel and Ezekiel 17 and 31. The birds are symbols for the Gentiles. So this tells us that this thing that begins small with seeds actually grows large enough to embrace also the Gentiles. And then the fourth parable in this first group, starting in verse 33, talks about the leaven and gives us the information that finally this reign and rule of God will penetrate throughout the whole world. And I think you could probably also add into that that it won't particularly look all that magnificent a lot of the times. I mean, one might think of, let's say today, there are millions of Christians in China, but you don't really know about it. So that first group talks about the reign and rule of God as it begins in Jesus Christ, small and insignificantly, and extends to the ends of the earth. The disciples then in verse 36 come and ask him to explain the parable of the wheat and the tares, and he does so. And now comes our text in verse 44. Now I take these as continuing. Notice in verse 44 it says, similar is the kingdom of heaven, and kingdom means the active reign and rule of God. It doesn't mean his realm, it's his active reign and rule. And normally, active reign and rule beginning in the ministry of Jesus Christ. Now, Tom, it was very interesting that in the one passage from Deuteronomy 7, it's in verse 6 actually, the people of God are called, it says, La'am Segalah. And that's Segalah, which is a treasured possession, very important word here. I'm going to take as a clue as to what we should do with the first of the last three parables, the treasure in the field, the face saw a row of the treasure. So let's translate verse 44, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Similar is the kingdom of the heavens to a treasure hidden in the field. Interesting that there's the article there, which may give us pause. Kekrimene is from crypto, perfect passive participle, probably to be seen in attributive position because thesauro does not have the article. And that means that it's in a hidden condition in the field, which, hoiron, upon discovering, a man hid, and from his joy goes and sells. Poleo is to sell, and often in kind of the most basic way, like bartering and things like that, all things, as many as he has, and buys that field. Now, my suggestion, and this would be getting on fairly early to sermonic suggestions, is that you, as you interpret the parable, which is what you have to do first, you have to decode it, you do not understand the man as us and the treasure being the kingdom of God. But rather, it is the man is Jesus and the treasure is the people of God, the Segulah. Now, Deuteronomy 7:6 was one reference. Exodus 19:5 is another reference where the people of God are given the appellation Segulah. And then you mentioned 1 Timothy 2:9, which is peripoiesis. Jesus is the one who comes upon this. And now let me just talk a little bit about the Palestinian background, because this is actually very important. In the law, a treasure, if it was not known, did not belong to the person who possessed the field. Thus, it does not work like mineral rights in the United States, where if you have oil on your land, and down in Texas, the drillers come and find this, you actually get royalties, even though you said, hey, I didn't even know I had that there. Well, it doesn't work like that in the Middle East. If you don't know there's a treasure, then you don't actually possess it. Secondly, you'll notice that the guy did not lift it. Now, this is actually important, because if this man was a day laborer, he was in the employment of someone who had hired him, and anything that he did, like lifting something up, would belong to the person who had hired him. So he simply covered it up. This was not illegal, immoral, or fattening. It was perfectly reasonable, and everybody would have understood this. This is not acting in any bad, illegal, or gross way. Now, when he bought the field, then he had possession of the treasure because he knew about its existence. Now let's do a little decoding here. Jesus is the man. These are kingdom parables. The whole thing throughout all of chapter 13 is what is the reign and rule of God in Jesus Christ like? Jesus gets the treasure, his own people. But he only gets the treasure as his own possession by buying the field. And the field, as Jesus decodes it up in verse 38 with the wheat and the tares, the field is the world. So, this is a great gospel message. God's people are redeemed, but that redemption is never the case apart from the redemption of all mankind. If there's not a sermon there somewhere, you're not trying hard. Now, verse 45, in my view, continues, but brings the focus, let's say, onto the individual. Again, similar is the kingdom of the heavens to a man, emporo, a merchant man, zeitunti, present active participle, seeking, or who seeks, could be a attributive position, because it's not, anthropo does not have the article, so the participle does not need the article. Seeking fine, valuable margaritas, pearls. So, Margaret, the name for the girl's name, Margaret, means pearl. By the way, this is an a declension masculine. Ha margarites. And upon discovering one, note the form henna. Henna is a masculine accusative singular because margarites is actually a masculine. And upon discovering one, polytimon. Poly and timus. Much valued. A much valued margaritane pearl. Op elthon, having gone away. Pepraken, from piprosko, to sell, a little less basic. I mean, this is more actually not barter selling, but selling, kind of like we would think of it. I'm going to talk about the form here in a second. But sells or has sold all things, as many as he was possessing, and bought it. Now let's take a look at that form, pepraken. Perfect active indicative third singular from piprosko. Now the perfect tense generally is a past act with a present result. In Hellenistic Greek, sometimes there is evidence, sometimes it is kind of almost pinch hitting for the aorist. Now that could be, or it could be that this is a real perfect, and that Jesus is the man, and that in fact he has sold everything, all that he has, a la Philippians 2. He gave up everything, and he did not count the thing to be held on to, but emptied himself. He humbled himself and took on the form of a servant. And therefore God has highly exalted him. But I'm wondering here if in fact this perfect shouldn't really be a perfect, and that you might say, if we think in terms of parable interpretation as a metaphor of vehicle and tenor, with the story being the vehicle and the tenor being the real story, you might say that the tenor is shining through the vehicle here. And he has sold all as much as he has and has bought it. Now, this I take to differ from the previous parable, in that this would kind of focus on the individual, whereas the previous one focuses on the people of God as a collective. Then comes the third parable in the final sequence here. Again, similar is the kingdom of heaven to a sagene, a net you drag along in the sea, blethaise, aorist passive participle, thrown into the sea, and synagoguse. Now look at that form. That is a feminine singular dative, aorist active participle of synago. And having gathered up ek pontos genus from every type. That is to say, some from every type. That's kind of a Hebraism. From every type. A hain, which, now that which refers to the dragnet, which, when eplerothe, it got filled up, anabibasantes. Now, anabibadzo is actually a sort of a transitive form for bino. So bino means to go, and bibadzo means to make something go. It's sort of like a hifio, like a hifio of bino, right. And so anabibadzo is to make to go up or to drag up. So, and having dragged it, hain, onto the strand, the sandy shore, and having sat down, kathisantes, aorist active participle, syn elexon, they picked out together, ta kala, the good things, for ange, that's a neuter plural from ta angus. It means like a vessel of some sort. The good things for vessels. And ta sapra, now I looked this up to be sure. Sapra is actually a word that's used quite a bit about fish. And it means rotten ones, bad ones, stinking ones. And the rotten ones out they threw. Hutos. Thus it will be in the syntelia in the close of the age. That's our age. Ex eloisantai hoi angeloi. Now note what Jesus is doing. Jesus is actually decoding the parable at this point. The angels will go out and aphorisousin. Now, let me just talk about that form, aphorisousin. That's from aphorizo, but the zo-stem verbs, like elpidzo, to hope, in classical Greek did not make their futures by becoming a sigma, like elpidzo, elpiso. They became futures by taking a contract verb pattern like the liquids. Like, for example, the future of Elpidzo would be Elpio. So this is aphoreousin, aphoreo. And they will separate out the evil ones from the midst of the just ones. And they will throw them into the furnace of fire. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, notice Jesus doing the... I like this parable for this reason. Notice Jesus doing the decoding. The angels are the they. And by the way, all of you should notice this. It's kind of an important point. That when all of a sudden a they comes in, this is a Semitism that is impersonal. They drag it up onto the beach. They don't light a candle and put it under a bushel. And if I may just digress here for a moment, in Luke 16, in the end of the parable of the the wicked servant who marks down the debts, you know, and it says, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal tents. They is probably not friends. They is this impersonal they, which is often the angels or the people of God, the servants of God. So I wanted just to relate 49 to 48, and also with a side glance at Luke chapter 16, and I believe that is verse 9, that interesting reference there to they receiving you. Yes, that's 16:9. And you find a parallel in Luke 12, verse 20, and 12, verse 48, that's identical with that impersonal use of they. So, then, who are the good ones? Well, those are the good fish. Now, what's dragging the net? Well, that's the close of the age. What's the beach? Hey, I don't think the beach is anything. This is part of the vehicle story, that there's just got to be there. They have to separate these someplace. So sitting down on the beach does not mean, like, say, Texas or something like that. It is just part of the details of the story, what I like to call slippage, which you don't necessarily have to interpret. So now notice, let's go back and let's look at the last three parables then. The last three parables, which are the lessons, the ones for 10 days from now, all I think focus on the believers more than anything else. Not sort of the spread of God's reign and rule, but that the believers are treasured, that they're valuable to God, and then in the third parable, that in fact they will be preserved in the vessels, and those who are evil will be separated at the end of time. So it's the final, what would you say, the final redemption and glorification of the believers. Now verses 51 and 52, which conclude the pericope. Synekate tauta panta. Did you understand all these things? Synekate is an aorist from syniemi. And it uses one of those aorists with kappa, like ethaka, dedoka, and this is heka. They say to him, yes. Note the ascendaton there. It's really interesting. There are no des or kais or uns or anything like that. This gives you the impression of a real quick conversation, and a conversation that's kind of lively. Have you understood, or did you understand all these things? They say to him, yes. Ha de aipen. It's switching the subject. He said to them, dia tuta, on this account, every scribe, gramma tois, every in the sense of any scribe, mate toi thais, aorist passive participle, masculine singular nominative, who has been discipled for the kingdom of the heavens. So I'm going to take that as attributive again. Every grammatois, scribe, who has been discipled for the kingdom of the heavens, is similar to an anthropo-oikodespotes, a man, a householder man, hostis, who, I'm going to take this as a non-restrictive clause, that this is by definition what householders are like. It's not separating good householders from bad ones. A householder who, by definition, ek balai, brings out, balo in a lot of these contexts doesn't mean to throw, it means to put or place or something like that. Almost like Pharaoh. Who brings out of his treasure kaina, new things, and palaya, old things. Well, another parable. Who is the grammatois? I think it's the followers of Jesus, particularly these disciples. They've been instructed for the kingdom of the heavens, and they're similar to a man. Now, notice that I'd like to refer verse 51 back to verse 44 and why I do not take it that it's about us. Because here he says, a scribe instructed for the kingdom is like a man. So it's not the kingdom is like a man, but this kind of a guy is like a man. So I think that gives you the clue, secondarily, that verse 44 is not about us and treasure, it's about God and us as the treasure. So it's the disciples. And what's the old and what's the new? Well, that's an interesting question. I think the new is the reign and rule of God in Jesus Christ. The old is that this is still building on the old covenant, and this would be a reference, I would take it, back to something like Matthew 5:17, don't think I have come to destroy the law and the prophets. I have not come to tear them down, but to fulfill. So Matthew's emphasis is always that, yes, something new is here, but it's not throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It is always building on what is old, and properly so. Thus, the people of God, like Exodus 19 or Deuteronomy 7, are God's segulah. They have always been his treasure. Okay, I think that is... are there any questions? Anyone here? Brings us toward the end of time. Okay, thank you very much.